Earth and Sky by Robert C. Newman. This is the first of four PowerPoint talks that were designed especially for an introductory astronomy course for homeschoolers that was held at Harvey Cedars Bible Conference in June of 2009. Here we talk about the Earth as a viewing platform, getting some handle on the movement of the heavenly objects, and then discussing the calendar. So, The Earth and Sky, Robert C. Newman. To begin our discussion of astronomy, we want to think about how things look from down here on Earth. What is happening in the sky as viewed from down here? We'll consider three topics: Earth as a viewing platform, the movement of heavenly objects, the calendar. First, the Earth as a viewing platform. The Earth is round, more or less. It is moving, that is, it is rotating on its axis. It's moving through space, and that involves several motions there, but we'll just leave it at that, moving through space. These were not usually recognized by humans in ancient times, so they saw the things in the sky as moving instead. Now, the ancients weren't dumb. We just had the advantage of many centuries of observations and considerably more advanced technology than they did. Take, first of all, the Earth is round. The clues that the Earth is round are somewhat subtle locally. We moderns have a huge advantage on this due to advanced transportation and communication. For instance, consider ships on the ocean. It's said that as a ship is moving away from you, the lower part disappears before the upper part due to the roundness of the Earth. Probably few people but sailors have ever really noticed this. Second, lunar eclipses. The shadow that the Earth casts on the Moon during the eclipse of the Moon is round. Here's a picture that gives you a little feel for that. The shadow is, of course, a good deal bigger than the size of the Moon, so you don't see but just a piece of it. But not many people in ancient times would have understood an eclipse of the Moon. Third, the height of the Sun. As one travels south, because the Earth is round, the Sun gets higher in the sky, or lower if one is going north. This was known some centuries before the time of Christ, and was in fact used to estimate the size of the Earth by one of the ancient Greeks, with actually fairly accurate results. Climate zones. Even more obvious to the average traveler was the fact that the climate gets hotter southward and colder northward. This could be misunderstood in various ways, like you're closer to the sun or something of that sort, but it actually has to do with the sun's rays striking more directly down on the Earth rather than at a rather substantial angle. Today, with easy travel and communication, we can see these things for ourselves. Another feature related to the roundness of the Earth is time zones. Traveling east or west, we notice the different time zones more easily than people even a century ago. Our particular time zones are only less than a century or so old, but the general effect of them has been noticed. Most of us have had to reset our watches when traveling, so we've had some direct experience with time zones as well. Thus, even without pictures from space, we have lots of evidence for a round Earth that the ancients did not have. Second, the question of the Earth is moving. That the Earth is moving is still more subtle than that the Earth is round, because the Earth doesn't feel like it's moving. Now, with modern closed vehicles that move smoothly, we sometimes are not sure whether we're moving or whether something outside the vehicle is moving. So we actually have some experience that can be possible to be moving and not feel like you're moving. Have you ever experienced this? The Foucault pendulum. It's possible to build a pendulum with a long enough cord that we can observe the rotation of the Earth underneath the pendulum. Many museums have such a pendulum to demonstrate this. the Coriolis effect. The rotation of the Earth also shows up in the way the wind turns right in the northern hemisphere and left in the southern hemisphere. Here we have a picture of the Earth shown from the side, a diagram of the Earth. And at the north and south pole, the air is very, the surface, of course, is very cold, and so air is cooled there, and the air then settles and flows away from the poles. And in the northern polar region, then the air turns right, and you get easterlies, and the air moving away from the pole at the south pole turns left, and you get easterlies. At the equator, the surface is rather hot, and so the air is rising, and new air is flowing in then to take the place of the air that's rising, and so you have air flowing towards the equator. And in the northern hemisphere, that turns right, and we get northeast trade winds. And in the southern hemisphere, this air flowing in towards the equator turns left, and we get southeast trade winds. The mid-latitudes are a little harder to understand, but basically the idea is that the air that rose at the equator is now settling back down to Earth at the horse latitudes, and is going to move away from those latitudes either southward towards the equator or northwards toward the poles. And that moving northwards toward the poles at the north horse latitudes turns to the right, and so you get westerlies. And that moving away from the horse latitudes in the south, moving south of that, turns left, and you get westerlies as well. So that explains those zones, three different zones in each hemisphere. And we can understand this a little more easily, perhaps, if we imagine riding on a carousel, a merry-go-round, and throwing a ball. And if we throw a ball from where we're riding, it will turn right. It actually works out if the carousel is turning to the left, is turning counterclockwise. And so the north half of our globe is turning counterclockwise, and so things turn to the right. And the south half is turning clockwise, and so they turn the opposite way. So that's the Coriolis effect, another evidence of the Earth rotating. That the Earth is moving through space as opposed to just rotating, this would have been even tougher for the ancients to detect, although there were some who believed the Earth was moving around the Sun. Today, with spaceflight, we can, of course, experience the Earth's motion relative to that of the Sun and planets more directly. We ourselves may never go on a space flight, but we know about people who have and things of that sort, so we've got a more direct effect there. Perhaps the most obvious evidence of our Earth moving through space for people who are not get on a space flight is what I call the bug on the windshield effect. Have you sometimes noticed that all the bugs that collect on your windshield on a hot day after a long drive in the country, were there any on the rear window? The answer, I think, would be, although you may never have checked it, many fewer and perhaps virtually none. And the question is, why not? And the answer is fairly simple, and that's this, that you're moving, say, 50 miles an hour on average in your car, and that will catch up with a lot of bugs that fly slower than 50 miles an hour that are traveling the same direction you are, and it'll catch up with all the bugs run across your windshield, you know, that come across your windshield flying to the right or left, and certainly smash all those bugs who are flying towards you, etc. But on the back window, the bugs that are flying slower than 50 miles an hour can't catch up. The bugs that are flying towards you from the front get blocked out by the car itself, or blown around it by the wake it's making, okay? And the side ones aren't likely to hit it either, so there just aren't going to be many bugs on the rear window. Well, something similar happens with meteors and the Earth, and they show us that the Earth is which way the Earth is moving. It shows you the Earth is moving through space, and tells us which way it's moving. The front side of the Earth is like the windshield, and the back side of the Earth is like the back window on your car. Here's a little diagram that shows that. As the Earth travels through space, the side experiencing times after midnight and before noon is the windshield, and meteors are the bugs. So, see this diagram here, and I'll read you the little text that goes with it. The portions of the Earth where local time, that is standard on daylight savings, is after midnight and before noon, or on the leading side of the Earth as it moves around the sun. It is this portion of the Earth that most meteors impact, just like snowflakes or bugs are more likely to hit the windshield of a car than the back window. Since meteors can only be seen when the sky is dark, the best chance for observing meteors is after local midnight and before the sun begins to lighten, before the sky begins to lighten before dawn. So, the side after midnight and before moon is the windshield, and the other side of the Earth after noon and before midnight is the rear window. And as the inscription there on that diagram pointed out, you don't see much in the way of meteors except after dark. Most of them are not bright enough to be seen in broad daylight. Amateur stargazers that do any meteor watching are familiar with this rule. The best time to look for meteors is after midnight. Not the best time to be up. Most people go to bed before then and then don't get up before dawn. But it's the best time to look, okay? That's when they're there. This is because the Earth really is moving through space, in this case around the sun, which is also what the meteors are doing, and the midnight to noon side is on the front of the moving Earth. Okay, well, that's all our discussion about the Earth as a viewing platform. What difference does that make, then, to the movement of heavenly objects as seen from the Earth? Well, what about the sun's movement? As we stand on the Earth, the sun appears to move across the sky once a day. That is, in fact, what makes a day. When the sun is up or nearly up, the sky is illuminated and it's daytime, okay? When it's down far enough that the sky is no longer illuminated, it's night, huh? As we now know, this movement of the sun across the sky once a day is due to the rotation of the Earth. Now the sun moves across the sky like that. Movement of the stars. Well known to the ancients, but less so to us, the stars also move across the sky once a day. If we watch the sky carefully, we'll see that the stars seem to be about 1 degree further west each night. And you work out what 1 degree means in time. It turns out that the sky appears to rotate about 15 degrees an hour. So divide an hour, 60 minutes, by 15, get 4 minutes. The stars will appear to rise about 4 minutes earlier each night. This is due to the rotation of the Earth, once a day thing, plus the movement of the Earth around the sun once a year. And so 4 minutes a night times 360, 365 actually, turns out to be basically 24 hours. So you get one extra rotation there. The moon's movement. The moon, too, moves across the sky about once a day. That's the rotation of the Earth. On top of this motion is another, and that's that the Earth, the Moon, is moving, what shall we say, to the east is the easiest way to say it. It's moving to the east around the Earth once a month, huh? So the Earth, the Moon, moves eastward relative to the stars and the Sun, and it does so in making a trip around once a month. So the moon rises nearly an hour later each night, going around the Earth. And the moon's phases are correlated with this as well. When the moon is in the direction of the sun, we have what we call new moon, and you can't see the moon unless it blocks the sun itself in a eclipse of the sun. And then when the moon has moved a quarter away around its orbit, we have what we call first quarter, or looking at the size of the moon as the moon looks in the sky, it's a half moon. And then as the moon moves another quarter way around its orbit, it rises basically when the sun sets, and you have a full moon. And then when it moves around one more quarter of its orbit, we have what's called third quarter. And that's, again, what we call a waning half moon, a waxing half moon, as it's getting the moon appears to be getting more of the moon is lit up, and then waning as less of it's lit up. Hmm? The fixed stars. We used to call the stars the fixed stars, not because they didn't move in the sky, but because they form patterns which look about the same for many thousands of years. These stars are actually moving rather rapidly, perhaps in the order of some 200 miles per second, but they're so far away from us that it takes centuries or even thousands of years to notice this. We call these star patterns the constellations. Nearly everyone is familiar with the constellation called the Big Dipper, technical name Ursa Major, Big Bear, although it includes more stars that way. In Britain, it's called Charles Wain, Charles Wagon, etc. And some other groups call it the Plow, etc. It looks a little bit like a handle with a plow, but Big Dipper, like a device for dipping water out of a basin or something of that sort to drink with. The lines, of course, are not there in the sky, and would be the lines your mind might draw to connect these particular ones together and help you to remember the pattern. Here's Orion shown without the lines. And you can see a pattern there as well, and that pattern sort of four fairly bright stars, one of which is rather reddish and one of which is rather whitish, and then between them this tilted triplet of stars, and down from that several other objects as well, one of which is actually a nebulosity, a cloud. This is imagined to be a hunter, and the upper star is his shoulders and the lower star is his legs or his knees or something, and the three tilted stars there are the belt, and the thing sticking down the sword from the belt. Usually add some other things for a lion skin he's holding up, and to the right of this thing, pattern as such as well. We don't have any good star charts far enough back to test the changing of constellations, but calculations based on the evidence of their motion suggest these pictures for the Big Dipper 100,000 years in the past and 100,000 years in the future. So today in the middle, 100,000 years ago, the handle is kind of tilted up at one end, and the dipper doesn't look like a dipper anymore. Looks more like maybe a trowel for putting cement on something. And then 100,000 years from now, the handle will be, it looks like it's bent badly the wrong way, and the dipper is sagging at the front end or something of that sort. Well, we turned into the planets. In contrast to the fixed stars, the ancients called some other objects planets, which comes from the Greek word wandering. So, wandering stars in contrast to fixed stars. These objects seem to wander among the fixed stars over the course of days or weeks. The ancients recognized seven planets: Sun, Moon, which we would consider planets today, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. So nowadays, we have promoted or demoted the Sun to be our local star instead of one of the planets. We've recognized the Earth is also a planet, notice it wasn't on the list, and that the Moon is just our Moon, and that some of the other planets have moons as well. And we've discovered three more planets, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, and then recently we have demoted Pluto to be a minor planet, or a Plutoid. Well, what about the movements of the planets? Well, all of them, again, move across the sky once a day, like our Sun, Moon, and stars, but each of them has an additional more complex movement. On top of that, Mercury and Venus move back and forth on either side of the Sun. So, typically moving eastward toward or away from the Sun, and then they stop and they move westward toward the Sun again and such. The outer planets, Mars and beyond, move slowly eastward among the stars, but then they take a strange westward loop, each of them at different times and different size loop, and that basically corresponds to the fact that our Earth is catching up with and passing that particular planet in our own orbit, and it causes this strange westward movement at one point, this westward loop. So that's the movement of the planets then. So we've looked at the movement of the Sun, the Moon, the stars, the Moon, and the planets. Conjunctions and such. The movement of the planets among the stars, as seen from Earth, meant that they would move among constellations, and that the planets would move relative to one another as well. This led to much of the complex fortune-telling that is called astrology. I have a PowerPoint talk on the merits of astrology and its problems scientifically and biblically, etc. You can look up that on my on our website. I think it's called Astrology, all right? conjunction is the term for when one planet appears to pass close, as viewed from the Earth, to another planet or to a particular star. It would be a conjunction. And then other terms were used for being in opposition, opposite side of the sky from the particular object, or being at square or trine or various things, various angles relative to the other object. And those worked out more easily on a chart of some sort than easily observable in the sky. So that's our quick tour of the movement of the heavenly objects. We come down to our last category in this talk, and that's the calendar. The calendar is something that took a good while to develop in antiquity. The basic units of the calendar, well, the shortest natural unit in the calendar is the day, the time it takes from sunrise to sunrise. That was probably the commonest way of looking at it, though some cultures use sunset to sunset, or noon to noon, or even midnight to midnight. Well, shortest natural unit is the day, time to, which we now know to be the time it takes for the Earth to rotate once on its axis. The other two natural units are the month and the year. The week is not a natural unit, and we understand from Scripture that it was revealed and has a purpose in God's salvation history. And then there's another use of the week, which may have been related to that, but which came to be connected with astrology. Well, what about the month? The month originally is the time it takes for the moon to come back to the same phase again, usually new moon to new moon and such. This was fairly easy to measure in antiquity, but it turns out not to be an exact number of days. It averages a bit over 29 and a half days. In ancient calendars, real months were commonly used, actual time between new moons, if you like. We use what we might call today fake months in our Western calendar. I don't know there's an official name for them. The year is the time it takes from the perspective of ancients looking at it for the seasons to come around again. And this is tougher to measure because of weather variations. You may have a colder or a warmer season or something, and so year or something, and so it's not as obvious when the seasons come back around. Since the seasons are driven by the tilt of the Earth's axis and how that faces the Sun, the year is the time it takes for the Earth to go once around the Sun. And the ancients turned out to be able to worked out easier ways to figure out what that was, not from measuring distance from season to season so much as measuring time between when the sun rose at the furthest north point or the furthest south point and back again to that same point again. Well, it turns out that the year is a bit under 365 and a quarter days, and this was known roughly in antiquity. It looks like pretty well everyone knew it was around 360, and your cultures that apparently put more effort into this knew it was around 365. Romans, using Greek astronomy, etc., worked out that you needed to add a leap year, that is, add an extra day every 4 years, and that was done already back in the time of Julius Caesar. And so the calendar in late antiquity was called the Julian calendar, and basically had a leap year added every 4 years. Since then, there's been a revision of that calendar called the Gregorian calendar. This was done in the late medieval, early Renaissance, Reformation period of not adding a fourth day on the century year, unless the century year was divisible by 400. So that basically knocks out three leap years in four centuries, and that makes us an even better fit to the seasons than the just adding this one extra day every fourth year. Well, various calendars are still in use. Our calendar is modified from the ancient Roman calendar with months of fixed length so they don't match the moon's phases. And this is called a solar calendar. Several other types of calendars had months which began at each new moon, and these are called lunar calendars. If a lunar calendar is adjusted so as to match the season, usually by adding a 13th month now and then every year or two, this is called a lunisolar calendar, and the traditional Jewish calendar is of this sort. If the lunar calendar is not adjusted, then each new year begins about 11 days earlier in the season than the previous one. The traditional Islamic calendar is like this. So countries that depend upon agriculture pretty heavily need to have a calendar that lines up with the season, so a solar, a lunisolar calendar necessary there. You remember the Arabs initially were desert dwellers, and we're not primarily agriculturalists, we're primarily, farmers anyway, but herders of one sort or another. And so perhaps did not need the question of when the seasons were going to occur so nearly, because that's a matter of when you plant certain crops. So the traditional Islamic calendar shifts, and so if you pay attention to the news reports of when Ramadan is going to be, you'll see that shifts from year to year. Well, that's our tour of this first module we call Earth and Sky, and we will stop there for this particular talk. Our second talk in this series is the one we call the Solar System.